Sheriff John Clark walked through the hotel lobby to the room that had once been the bar. Numb of brain and body, he moved with bent head and sagging stride. The place now only dispensed soft drinks and held card tables packed in from wall to wall. There was only a scanty gathering in this social center of the town tonight, but those who ventured through the gale were hardened old adventurers whom the sheriff had known half his life, men in whom habits had become riveted by long usage. He surveyed their faces for an instant with stern satisfaction. These were men of his kind. Then he stepped toward the stove and stood before it with his hands extended until a steam of hot vapor rose from them. Now Bud Morton, still carrying a juvenile nickname through 60 years of hearty action, approached and dropped his hand on the shoulder of the sheriff.
I sure grieved a pile when I heard what happened. What's done is done. Buck up, old man. You still got a long life ahead of you. If it ever comes to a pinch where you need help or a friend, you can call on me. And here's a dozen more would stand by you, John.
There was a profound hush of sympathy in the room. The sheriff could not turn his head. There was only one right answer to this speech, and that was to tell them that there was no call for sympathy to be expressed to him. His son was alive and well. Alive, well, and a self-confessed coward. He himself, John Clark, known through 5 states as a fearless man, would rather die than have the shame of his son known. But what could he do? He shrank in all his soul from letting the good men of Varden City continue to think the shifter a murderer. Still, he dared not proclaim his son alive, for yonder in the corner he marked the cold, steady eyes of Kruger, the gambler, the gunfighter. The doughty old sheriff would think twice before he invited trouble with the man. He would think twice before he invited trouble, but he would not wait to even think once before he accepted it. That was the difference between himself and his son. That was the difference between courage and cowardice.
Thanks, old-timer. Thanks.
Clark scowled down at the stove. How could he explain to them the truth without giving the information to Kruger? Kruger looked up from his hand.
There's one good thing, and that's the fact that you got the killer so quick. He'll pay for Jack. He'll pay plenty.
The sheriff raised his head and flashed a glance at Kruger. After all, the man had generous instincts, for otherwise, what kept him from telling the sheriff how much was owing to him from his son and demanding payment of the gambling debt, which of all debts is the most sacred?
I got to get away. I was an idiot in the first place to come among them.
He must have time and space for thought, and the storm was a fitting accompaniment to the tumult in his brain. Old Nick, the bartender, smote his hand flatwise upon the bar.
Gents, line up and stand up! What are we gonna do for old John Clark?
They looked at him in surprise, then muttered to one another. What had gotten into placid old Nick? But there he stood with his face lighted, and not pleasantly lighted at that. He was a formidable figure as to chest and stomach, and formidable as to hand also. It was rather fat than brawny now, though there was strength left in it, and many a man, aye, even of those at that moment present, could have testified to the power which once dwelt in that hand in the days of his prime, when Nick, disregarding the threat of guns, had more than once stepped in between brawlers and hurled them indiscriminately through the door to roll in the dust outside.
Gents, I've served drinks in a good many towns and worked behind a good many bars in my day. I've done my turn in towns where the gold was coming from the ground so fast that the boys burned their throats out, turning the dust into whiskey and getting it down. But I've never seen a town act so plumb orderly and peaceful as Varden City. That's why I stuck when I came here 20 years ago. And why was it peaceful? There ain't any doubt about why. It was the sheriff. It was old John Clark. Did I have gunfighters smashing up my furniture in here in a way that would have turned the stomach of an honest man to come in here for a quiet drink? I didn't, because the gunfighters was always scarce in Clark's County. Did I have stick-up artists come along and clean out of the money box on me? I didn't, because the stick-up artists sure hated the ground where John Clark walked. Did I have slick card sharks come along and trim all the boys that played in my place? I didn't, because old John Clark was always a-sitting right over there in that old armchair in the corner. That one with the initials carved all over the arms. John could spot a card crook a mile away. Well, boys, it's sure a pleasure to serve drinks in a town that has a sheriff like John Clark. And here's what I'm coming to. For the sake of what he used to do, and for the sake of all the drinks that have spun across this here bar, I sure move that we take a job off Clark's hands and finish up this wild young man killer, this shifter as they call him. Now, are the rest of you with me, or are you not?
There is a cumulative power in words. They build out of nothing. They lead nowhere. But out of them comes an effect. They have, at least, the value of mass. They have the emphasis of quantity, and the emphasis in the case of Nick was pointed by a fierce energy which came of his heart. What above all gave the words of the bartender point was that no one in the crowd had even remotely suspected him of containing in his heart such emotion. When one has jested with a man, shaken his hand, and clapped him upon the shoulder for an indefinite period, it is very difficult to take the same man seriously, but when he actually does become serious, the effect is most astonishing. The effect was at least astonishing now, as regarded the old and hardened cattlemen who listened to the eloquence of Nick. First they stared at him, then they gasped at him, and at length they glanced at one another as though to check up their own impressions by the impressions of their neighbors. When they found their neighbors taking this fellow seriously, they turned back to Nick with corrugated brows, which were in themselves an ample token that they meant business. Shame, then, was the bellows from which air rushed upon the fire, and shame is a power well worth taking into consideration. Too few are those who think upon it seriously, but shame is that thing which makes the soldier step out before his mates and dare the impossible. At least, it operated powerfully upon the good men of Varden City, although there was some argument on the matter. Bud Morton shook his gray head as he spoke.
Speaking personal, I always figured that Jack Clark was no more like his father than a half-blood colt of a Mustang mare is like a thoroughbred sire. He's mean by nature, a sneak by training, and a hound by general principles. Anybody here can step out and say that I'm the sheriff's friend. I've proved it with powder and lead, which outtalks words a good many ways. But I'm also here to state that no matter how much I like the sheriff, I ain't over fond of his son. If the rest of you would dig down into your vitals and talk true, I think you'd say the same. I've seen Jack quiet, and I've seen him loud. I've seen him talking friendly, and I've seen him talking mean. I'm cussed if I ever seen him talk or act the way I like to see a man. He always made me figure that he was only one part a man. At that, I've always give him the best part of the guess. I've always tried to see his father in him, but I ain't never been able to see much of John Clark and Jack Clark. Them two don't seem to string together. Why are we figuring to hit this gent they call the Shifter? We figured to go after him because he met Jack Clark on the one-way trail. Well, what are the facts? The facts are that the Shifter was going the right way, and Jack Clark was riding the wrong way on the one-way trail. Well, boys, work it out for yourselves. It ain't hard to do. Suppose you or me was to meet a gent riding the wrong way on a trail when there wasn't room for two gents to pass. What would we do? I ask you that. What would we do? Why, we'd simply up with a gun and get rid of the gent that was superfluous. And this ain't the first time, because there's Hugh Near. Didn't Hugh Near take the wrong way of the trail? And didn't he get shot by Billy Jordan? And didn't Billy come into town and boast about what he'd done? And didn't all of us shake Billy's hand? I ask you that.
As the group considered, there arose from the ranks of the crowd one who was willing to stake his wits against the wits of all the others. Not because he felt that he was inherently right, but simply because he desired to fight the great majority. This is the impulse driving men to support lost causes. What wonder that it showed itself here in the person of the gray and venerable Jefferson Smith. Jefferson Smith was, so to speak, a Tartar. In other words, he generally did the opposite of what people expected. Because he was the opposite of their expectations, it is not strange to hear that he was generally detested. Jefferson Smith was able to impart to the smallest thing that aroma of the important, which may not exist in fact, but which is very apt to exist in inference. He was one of those men whose inferences are more important than their statements. It was this Jefferson Smith, then, who spoke up. They turned on their heels, they turned in their chairs, and they beheld Jefferson Smith. Even in their detestation, it is not for nothing that in the West a man has shot a 5-cent piece at 30 yards and blown its center out. It is not for nothing either that a man has killed 3 hard-fighting warriors of Colt 45 and Bronco. Every man in the barroom of the hotel turned himself toward Jefferson Smith and watched him with the eye of one intent. Which side would Jefferson take?
Gents, it seems to me that we're all wasting a pile of valuable time about a mighty small thing. Are all of us going to stand around here and spend the night chattering about a youngster like the Shifter? Bah, I've heard of him. We all have. We've heard him talked about as a man-killer, a bad one.
Jefferson turned his eye deliberately over the little crowd, and deliberately he picked out his 2 worst enemies.
Give me Calkins and Bud Morton to stand with me, and the 3 of us will take on 30 of such half-baked bad men. Boys, I say we ought to ride up the hill to Clark's place, take this Shifter out of his cell, string him up to the highest tree we can find, and leave him there, flapping in the breeze, as a sign to others of what Varden City does to the bad men who come its way.
He pointed his speech with action as he stepped toward the door.
Who's coming with me? Or do you want me to go alone?
Allison had not gone to bed. She sat with her face so close to the window in her room that sometimes the pain pressed cold against her nose. Whatever she saw was noted only in semi-consciousness. Her mind was busy, terribly busy, with a host of thoughts crammed into it this day. The Shifter, Harry French, was a gunfighter, a known bad man. It seemed impossible that this could be the case, but then she was sadly ignorant of men.
It might be I like him so much simply because he's the opposite of John and Jack.
She admitted this to her reason, but reason did not satisfy her. If the Shifter were really bad, then she felt that there was no such thing as goodness in the world. The very sound of his voice thrilled her with happiness. The very memory of it was a joy.
But I don't know much about things. Most likely I'm wrong. I don't know about men.
She had not entirely obeyed the command of her guardian to keep away from the Shifter. She had stolen down into the cellar after she'd finished with the dishes, and the Shifter rose with a smile to greet her. She could not muster courage to speak. Something choked her. So she turned, and once her back was toward him, a cold panic sent her scurrying up the steps through the hall and up again to her room. Here she stayed, crouched beside the window ever since.
Sheriff forget his key?
The thought of the sheriff in a passion was quite sufficient to blot out all other considerations from her mind.
It's the girl!
I forgot about her. It's the girl. That makes it bad.
Who are you? Uncle John isn't here. I think you'll find him in the hotel.
Instead of answering, one of the men pushed in. He had a sharply pointed little gray beard, glittering little gray eyes. He was withered with the passage of 60 years or more, but he had dried up without growing feeble. He stared through and through her. He seemed to be poking into veiled corners of her nature. There was nothing that could be hidden from this terrible man. Others came in behind him. Some of them were big, all of them were quite old, and all of them had brows wrinkled with knowledge of the world and its men and women and events. Allison shrank back toward the wall.
You can come in, of course. I'll build a fire for you in the front room and make you some coffee. You must be terribly cold and wet.
The little man turned toward the others.
I'll handle this.
Then he turned back to Allison and laid his hand on her shoulder. The hand on her shoulder was light as the touch of an affectionate child.
Now don't you go bothering about us, honey. Don't you go bothering to fix up coffee. We'll get along without that.
thing for you to do is just trot back up to your room and go to bed. We know the sheriff ain't here, but we've come to do something that he'll be glad to have done. We're all old friends of his, you see.
He patted her shoulder lightly as he spoke, and yet it seemed to the sensitive eyes of the girl that there was no reality in his smile. He was not talking to her, but around her, just as the sheriff often talked when he wished to keep his true meaning from her. Being a specialist, as one might say, in pain, she recognized the same tactics in Jefferson Smith. The other men stepped quietly into the hall and closed the door softly behind them. It embarrassed them hugely to find only this reputedly weak-minded girl as a garrison in the sheriff's house. It was like attacking a helpless woman, in a way.
I'll go upstairs with you. You can show me the sheriff's office. Can you do that?
She was deeply in thought. She knew it was by no means ordinary for a group of men to call in the absence of John Clark and calmly ask to be shown into his office. In the guilty, storm-reddened faces of the men, she had striven in vain to read the secret. She showed her guest to the door of the sheriff's office. He paused there with his hand on the knob.
All right, honey. Now you run along to bed. Good night, and happy dreams.
She looked wistfully up into his face. In spite of his smiling lips, his forehead remained stern. What was going on inside his mind? But all she could do was nod slowly and then turn away down the hall as Smith entered the room. The sound of the cell keys brought Allison whirling back to the door with her heart aflutter. There was only one reason for wanting those keys, to get at the shifter. And there, through the partly open door, she saw Jefferson Smith turning away from the desk with the big, shining bundle of keys in his hand and on his face an expression of cold and sinister purpose. She reached in and drew the door to her. Cautiously slipping the key from the lock, she fitted it again on the outside, noiselessly shut the door, and turned the lock. So softly had she worked that Smith, half blinded by the flare of the match close to his eyes, was not suspicious. There was such a terror in her now that she had acted that she could not move, but leaned half fainting against the wall of the hall.
Hello? What the devil?
He wrenched loudly at the door.
Hello? Help! Hey, Boris, this little vixen has tricked me and locked me up here like a rat in a trap!
The shouting of the storm still was louder than the voice of Smith, and there was no rush of footsteps from the lower part of the house. But at any moment, it might begin. She turned and fled down the hall. Her mind worked with singular precision. She raced to the tool room behind the kitchen, and there, with swift and sure touch, she jerked open the big tool chest in the corner and drew out the steel saw and the oil can. More than once she had seen the sheriff work with it. More than once she had seen him handle stout iron. Thus equipped, she hurried down to the hall and slipped through the cellar door. They had heard Jefferson Smith, and they were rushing to his rescue. How long would the locked door hold them at bay? She tossed the key down the steps and ran straight to the cell. The lantern now illumined the big room very faintly, for it was turned low. The shifter, lying asleep on his cot, was a blotchy shadow among shadows. The girl pressed her face against the cold bars.
Quick, quick! They've come for you! Wake up!
One bound brought him to his feet, staring wild-eyed at her.
They've come here! Here's the saw. I'll put on the oil.
Who's come?
Jefferson Smith and a lot of others. Hard-faced men, and they mean to take you away. They've taken the keys in the sheriff's office and...
Oh, lynching party. Good Lord.
The saw began its small, shrill song as it cut into the steel bar until she silenced it with a trickle of oil from the can.
Hurry, hurry! Oh, quick! I hear it coming!
The shifter cast the saw jangling to the floor and grasped the bar. It held as though it were a column of stone. They were shooting through the lock on the cellar door, but that massive old-fashioned lock would surely turn their bullets without giving way.
Once more!
Allison added her own small strength, now made large in her frenzy. Suddenly, the bar snapped. The shifter struggled through, and then he lay sprawling on the floor at her feet. At the same instant, the cellar door burst from its hinges and went crashing and bounding down the steps with a flood of yelling men pouring through behind it.
Get him! Shoot to kill, boys! He's loose!
She saw a flash of fighting rage come into the eyes of the shifter. Then he caught up the fallen saw and flung it at the lantern, which hung from the rafter a few yards away. The lantern fell crashing. and the big cellar went thick dark.
Get off my foot!
A hand gripped Allison.
Is there another way out? Is there another way besides one back into the house?
Yes! Yes! If I could only find it in the darkness! Oh, heaven help us!
Deftly, she guided him down the alley through the cells and then sharply to the right until they ran into the rear wall of the house.
I said, get off my foot!
Here and there, match glowed, cupped in big hands, but those feeble cups of light were not able to throw a ray into the far corner where Allison fumbled for the old door. At least, there was a sufficient glimmer of light for her to see that the way was blocked with a big box, and she pointed it out to the prisoner. His hands were instantly on it. It was flung to the side. One thrust of his shoulder and the door went open.
He's getting away!
Then she stood with him in the freshness of the night, with the wild rain whipping about them.
Which way?
Here!
She barely gave him the signal when he was off, and she, racing beside him, was able to keep up because of her knowledge of the ground. They reached the sheltering darkness of the trees side by side behind the house.
Go back and get lights! We'll run the fool down! He can't get far on foot! Newt Barkley and Saunders, run for the stable and see that he don't get off of the horse. If you see anything, don't wait to ask questions. Shoot to kill. Jerry, wait here and watch this door so he don't double back like a fox. The rest of you, come this way!
Now you've sure done your share. You give me a running start and I'll do the rest of it. Go back to the house.
Go back and face the sheriff? Oh, I'd sooner die. You don't know him. He'll kill me for this.
Is he that kind? But you can't go with me.
Shall I go alone then? I know the ground. I can show you where to go. A place they'll never search for you. Only one other person in the world knows about it. And I won't be much in your way. I'll run every step.
Lord bless you. In the way, after saving me, I'll keep you in spite of everything. I only had a gun. I only had a measly little 22. But bare hands are better than nothing. Which way now?
Follow me!
They labored up a weary climb, their feet slipping on the muddy slope. But never once did the courage or the spirit of the girl fail her, so that the shifter was struck with wonder again and again.
It's a shortcut. They'll never dream of coming this way. And the best of it is that the rain will wash out our footmarks. They won't last till the morning.
And what are you? What will you do, Allison? Are you going to give up your home?
It's not a home. It's a prison. Oh, if you knew how I love even the rain and the wind because I'm free at last. My whole soul is breaking out and growing bigger. I feel strange to myself. I'm so happy and...
She stopped suddenly and caught at his arm.
Listen.
Well?
Do you hear wailing?
It's wind. Yes, I hear.
No, not the wind. I've heard it before. I heard it when the jailbreak came last spring and the two men got away. Jefferson Smith has got out his hounds. Listen again. We're almost there. Well, what good will it do to go into the cave? They'll follow us even there.
Will the scent hold in all this rain?
Uncle John says that the Smith dogs can follow even the thought of a man.
If we're near the cave, then let's go there and sit down a minute to think. My head's in a whirl in this infernal wind. Come on.
This is it. At least this cave will give us a cutoff and gain time. It passes clear through the hill and opens on the other side.
Suppose we cut through it and then block the other end with the stones. The hounds may be thrown off.
Yes, yes. At least we can try.
She led the way, dropping to her hands and knees and crawling through the black mouth of the cave. The shifter followed and found himself in pitchy darkness. For perhaps 20 feet, he crawled on behind the girl, bumping his head when he attempted to straighten. But at length, he was able to see her rise to her feet, and he followed her example. The cave widened to comfortable dimensions. The smell of wet ground was thick around them, mixed with another scent, fainter and sharper.
Allison. There's someone else here. I smell wood smoke. A fire has been burning in the cave.
That can't be true. There's only one other person in the world who knows about it, and that's poor Jack. He and I used to come up here when we were little ones. Jack showed it to me. The wood smoke may have drifted up here and stayed here without being blown out.
But?
He checked himself. The shifter struck on again through the cave, bending far over to avoid striking his head against any projection. For some 10 yards, the passage held straight on. Then it veered sharply to the right, and the shifter, striding blindly ahead, struck solidly against a rock wall. On the sound of his voice, he was paralyzed with astonishment to have a broad shaft of light flashed upon him.
Hands up! Hands up, whoever you are!
The shifter obeyed.
If you're hiding out here, partner, I'm not hunting you. Matter of fact, I'm in the same boat, and
you...
The shifter could make out the outlines of the figure and even the glimmer of the revolver which he held in his right hand as he poised the electric torch on the left.
I figured I'd meet you again, but I never dreamed I'd get a chance to get back at you so quick. Now, son, you'll pay me for my horse you killed, and you'll pay me big. Who's that with you?
Oh, Jack! Oh, then all the danger is over. Don't you see? It's Jack Clark. He's not dead. He's not dead!
Good Lord!
The torch wavered in Jack's hand as he recoiled.
Allison! What are you doing up here with him? What are you doing up here?
The mind of the shifter groped vaguely toward the truth. Here was the murdered man, after all, safe and sound, and lurking like a condemned criminal escaped from the law.
You'd have hung up here. Stayed right up here while they was holding me for killing you. Clark, you'll pay me big for this.
Will I? And suppose I stop your trail right now. If I catch you running off with a girl, do you suppose I ain't got the right to stop you with a bullet?
The shifter had been resting one hand against the rocky side of the passage. Now, in his blind rage, his fingers contracted strongly.
You hound!
Somebody's shooting!
Up to the very mouth of the cave, the hounds dragged Smith. He pulled them to one side, and the others crawled into the black hole. The scent of burned gunpowder lingered inside to guide them. Morton had found an electric pocket lantern before he left the sheriff's house, and with this, he now probed the passage with a dim shaft of light. They turned the corner of the tunnel at a run, so came full upon a strange group. A man lay sprawled on his face, motionless. Another man stood above him, leaning against the wall and staring stupidly down at the stricken one. Allison crouched, weeping, nearby.
Oh, it's me. He tried to shoot me. I hit him with this rock. And I think this time you got some call to hang me, boys.
Bud Morton turned the fallen man on his back.
Oh, my. It's Jack Clark.
It was a face half muddy and half pale, and from the side of the head, a trickle of crimson ran down his face.
Is he dead?
Morton lay his hand over Jack's heart.
No.
Oh, he'd better ought to be. Of all the dirty pieces of work I've ever seen or heard of, boys, this is the rottenest. Don't you see it? To get even with the shifter there, who killed his horse and maybe licked him fair and square on the one-way trail, this skunk waited up here till the shifter swung for the job or got lynched. Lynch the shifter? Why, boys, we'll step up and tell him we were wrong and we're a pile sorry for what's happened.
It required time to bring about the conclusion. In that time, Jack Clark, a sadly humbled and humiliated young man, went north, far north, into a new country to carve out for himself a new name and a new character. And since there is possibility of change in even the worst of us, Jack succeeded beyond the dreams of even his father, who went with him. There in the north, they settled down as farmers in an unknown community. And the letters that drifted south to Allison were all of prosperity, home building, and finally the marriage of Jack. They will tell you the story even today in Varden City, particularly when a stranger is guided through the main street and past the big house at the head of the thoroughfare, its gables barely visible above the surrounding treetops. For Harry French, late the shifter, and his wife now live in the big house. Their greatest friend is that formidable gunfighter, Jefferson Smith, who takes all the credit for their romance on his own shoulders.
I smelled a rat from the first, and then I ran it down with the dogs. No matter if the name of the rat was not the one I started after, the fact is that I found a rat.
No one cares to dispute Jefferson Smith. Certainly not the shifter, whose guns rest in peace. Guipago's Vow by Cynthia Hasselhoff. 5 hard years on, Guipago stood amidst trees, watching a schoolhouse, waiting for the man he knew was inside. He refused the peace road after his son Tanankia's death. Over those 5 years, he led his Kiowa people away from the agencies. He led them to war. He led them to starvation. He led them to surrender. He led them to imprisonment. He led them to death. When Guipago brought his people in, the white men put him with the other chiefs and warriors in the unfinished ice house at Fort Sill and threw chunks of meat over the high walls to feed them as if they were wolves. A Kiowa cannot stand prison. The life of a free man who spends his life on a horse, moving over endless prairies, suddenly holds nothing once he wakes to a thick-walled cell and its small window covered with bars. Guipago existed alone in the prison at Huntsville, Texas. Enfeebled, life draining from him with each day, he ran off from the second floor of the hospital and found again his freedom. To live in prison, a man must have patience. He must have purpose. Some men found ways to be patient, passing the time with drawing or working or gambling or sleeping. Some men found purpose in the hunger again to see their children and wives, mothers and fathers. Guipago found patience and purpose in his vow to Tanankia. The white man came out of the schoolhouse. Guipago watched him closely. John Gopherth Ditsworth climbed the ladder propped against the building and returned to his work on the shingles. The teacher looked unchanged. Still thin and tall, his cropped hair stuck out where he ran his hands through it as he read. Rimless spectacles still aided his gray, myopic eyes. Guipago touched the cuffs and chain that hung from his saddle as he watched.
So, Junji, you have not gone home. You are still meddling with the poor Kiowas. Will your gentle God protect you from me? This time, I do not think so.
He trotted his pony into the schoolyard.
Junji! Junji! Come down and talk to one who has been away a long time.
Friend John, called Junji by the Kiowas from his first introduction as Junji Ditsworth, looked down on the Kiowa chief who sat looking up at him. Unlike many Kiowas, Guipago sat lean and sinewy. His face showed tight copper skin stretched over hard angles. A few deep seams allowed it to move. Prison left not much outward change. His hair remained dark as ever, worn in the old way, with the left braid cut off below the ear and the right wrapped in red flannel. Earrings of shells and watch chains ornamented the margins of his ears. He wore a white shirt under a white man's vest and a pair of frayed gabardine trousers, but on his feet he wore moccasins, beaded and trailing long fringes. Guipago appeared dressed up. John did not see but felt something about the chief not there before, a sadness. Perhaps he grieved for Tanankia, the lost people, lost years. The Quaker laid down the shingling hatchet carefully on the new split wood.
Guipago, the children said thou were home. Why hast thou taken so long to come to the school? There are many things I want to show thee.
After 10 years among the Kiowas, the schoolteacher could speak their language without thought, but he spoke now in a Quaker's English. John backed down the ladder.
And are you, Junji?
Get down, Guipago.
John reached up to shake the Kiowa's hand.
I have my lunch inside and we will eat something.
John had never entered a Kiowa lodge without an offer of food. Many times he ate while his hosts went without. Guipago stepped down from the pony, tossing the rope reins high on the horse's neck. The horse followed him like a puppy.
I see your horse has not forgotten you.
No, he has not forgotten the old ways.
Best buffalo pony I ever saw.
Where is your woman, Junji?
She has taken the children back to Ohio during the summer recess. Their grandparents are hungry to see them.
Yes, one can grow hungry to see a child.
Ditsworth looked down at the dust he kicked as they walked. On the porch, he found his lunch and offered a sandwich to the Indian. They ate together in silence on the steps, watching the sky and land around them. In time, Quipago stood.
Come, Chonji. It is time to go from here.
The teacher left his sandwich and stood beside the chief. He wiped his hand on his trousers, ready for the final handshake that always formally ended a visit.
I had hoped thou would stay and talk with me as we once talked.
There is something I want to show you.
They walked to his horse. He removed the chain and cuff from the saddle.
Look, Chonji. This is what the white men put on me when I surrendered.
Ditsworth looked at the shackles, his gentle jaw set. All his life, the man hated chains, the symbol of the power of one man over another. He saw their marks on the fleeing slaves he and others of his faith smuggled north. He felt his own shame and the disgrace of his people when they fit shackles over the Indians' wrists and ankles.
Hold out your hands, Chonji. I will show you how iron feels on flesh.
The Quaker offered his wrists and watched as the Kiowa placed the cuffs over them and clamped the iron together.
There. We can go now.
John Ditsworth looked up into the Kiowa's black eyes.
Go?
Yes. You are my prisoner.
Thou art my friend.
You are my white man.
This will cause trouble, Quipago.
No, Chonji, this will not cause trouble. I have thought about this. You are the perfect white man. Your woman is away and will not miss you. The other white men and the Indians know that you travel about among the bands. They will think you have gone somewhere with someone else. They will not miss you. And your God will not let you fight me.
And what dost thou intend to do with me?
I will kill you.
The teacher looked about him. He did not doubt that Quipago had the will and the power to kill him. He was a Quaker, not a fool. He never grew blind to the depredations of the Kiowas, even as he loved them. He put his life in their bloody hands many times, in the belief that a man, red or white, can change when he was led gently to a better way. Quipago dropped the rope noose over John Ditsworth's head.
Come, Chonji. We will find your horse. Our road is long.
Quipago led Chonji from civilization through the broken land and sand hills into the twilight and across the moon-made shadows. He did not stop to rest, to eat, to sleep. He let the horses drink at the streams they crossed. He did not let John drink or eat. They rode on into the coming day, into the heat of noon, and into the blessed benediction of twilight, before Quipago pulled Chonji from the saddle and tossed him a slice of dried meat and a gourd of water.
Sleep now.
John let the water quench his thirst and cool his parched lips before speaking.
This is about thy vow, isn't it?
Quipago checked the knotted rope around Janji's neck and tied the end around his own arm.
Chonji, if you run, I will only find you. Sleep now.
Quipago rolled into his blanket. The night was as cold as the day was hot. John looked at the shackles on his wrists. The flesh was red and worn away.
Friend John, thou art a fool.
A thought skittered across his brain. Friend John, get up and smite this loathsome heathen Indian to death and make thy escape. Then the small voice inside arose.
Friend John, will thy faith stand, though sorely tried?
On the third day, after bathing his face and singing his morning song to the Great Spirit, Quipago untied himself from John, removed the noose casually, and coiled the rope and dropped it over his saddle. Hollow-eyed John Ditsworth sat against some rocks with his shackled hands draped over his outspread knees.
You should sleep, Chonji.
This is about thy vow to Tanakya, isn't it?
Yes.
Thou proposed to take me to Mexico and kill me on the spot where Tanakya was killed?
Yes, that is the vow. How do you know this vow?
It is a famous vow. Kicking Bird warned me, but that was so many years ago. It washed away.
You should have listened. A famous vow must be kept. It never washes away. A man would lose his face. Then he would have to die. Come, Chonji, saddle your horse.
John bridled and saddled his horse with gentle care.
You are good with the horse. Not like an Indian, but good. A quirt would move that one better.
We do not strike other creatures, beast or man.
John stood with his heavy saddle in hand and glanced at Quipago, busy with his own horse. The two men stood together between the animals, the Indian working and preparing to mount from the right, the white man from the left.
Quipago.
John swung the saddle into Quipago's face. Quipago fell back. John threw himself onto his horse. The animal streaked across the prairie. The best buffalo pony that John had ever seen soon closed the distance to the big American horse without any effort. When Quipago came alongside, he struck the Quaker full force with the backward swing of his fist and forearm. The blow sent him tumbling off. The buffalo pony cut away. Quipago circled it into a stop in front of the fallen man. John saw the blood on the Indian's cheek where a stirrup had hit him. He lay back. Quipago turned his horse and rode after the other animal that had stopped to graze. He led it back to John. The teacher stood up, dusting his clothes and rubbing an elbow hurt in the fall.
John G!
Quipago looked straight into his eyes as he stuck a rifle behind the ear of John's horse. The horse crumpled after the concussion of the gun. John looked down at the dead animal and then up into Guipago's face. Quipago tossed his rope over John's head and tightened it.
You will walk now, John G.
Quipago turned his horse away and led the teacher behind him.
You are a child in these matters.
The next days meant agony, even for a man accustomed to walking. John suffered as the world turned under his feet. Quipago, though once thoughtful and sometimes eloquent in counsel, now found words tiresome, even useless. He spoke his vow. Only action remained. Each step brought him closer to the fulfillment of the only important words left. John G. Ditsworth had learned as a child to wait in silence for the still, small voice within him. These past days, he missed it in the tumbling thoughts of his mind. His fear ruled him, leading him to the foolish escape attempt. As he walked behind Quipago, he worked to quiet the tumult. At last, it began to speak.
Thou didst lose thy faith back there. Thou didst run without being sent, taking matters into thine own frail hands. Friend John, thou art not a warrior, and not suited to contend with men of war on their own terms. Remember thyself.
That night, John retrieved the worn journal from his jacket pocket and began to write. Quipago watched as the sunburned man bent over the pages beside the fire.
July 19th, 1879. Quipago and I are traveling now toward the site of his son's death in Mexico. Kicking Bird told me, when Quipago found his son's body lying on the ground, he kneeled down and vowed to the Great Spirit that on the ground where his son was killed, he would take the life of some white man. To kill a white man on that ground, he would have to catch one and take him there. Quipago says, I am the perfect white man for his purpose. I have been among this people with much sorrow and many tears, a stranger among a strange people. Yet hath the Lord supported me by the right arm of his power, notwithstanding my many slips by the way. He has sustained and upheld me in all and through all. Even at times when his presence has been, or seemed to be, withdrawn, his hand has been underneath to bear me up and keep me from falling, to make a way where man could make no way, and to overrule the counsels of the most hostile men. It may be, although Quipago does not mean it for good, that I am the perfect man for his purpose.
What do you scratch upon the papers?
I am writing a record for my family. I do not want them, when they learn what becomes of me, to worry that I suffered from great anguish or fear.
You should be afraid. I am going to kill you for sure. Do not think that I will not. You are nothing to me, one way or the other. Perhaps I even like you a little, but I will keep my vow.
Yes, I also made a vow long before I knew thee or these circumstances. I had nearly forgotten it in the cares of life. I broke that vow. I repent me of it. Guapago, I ask thy forgiveness for hitting thee with the saddle and causing thee pain.
I forgive you, Junji. Pain? A mosquito bite.
As the days of long marches continued, a pattern began to evolve. They rose early. Guipago bathed his face and sang his morning prayers. John sat in silence, listening to his inner voice. During the day, the men rarely spoke at all. Guipago was not generous with food or water, but merely sustained his prisoner. He kept the rope on his neck and rode triumphantly before him. In the evening, they made a small fire. Guipago had coffee and sugar, which he did not share. John wrote in his journal. The Indian played cards.
Junji, play cards with me.
I do not play cards, Guipago.
The Indian tossed a card toward John's hat.
You don't play cards, you don't drink whiskey, you don't smoke cigarettes. And you have only one woman, Junji. You lead a pitiful life, and soon you are going to die.
Another card sailed into the black hat.
I should take you to the Comancheros and show you a good time before I kill you.
John closed the book.
I am not discontent with my life. I have chosen it, knowing its joys and disciplines, just as thou hast chosen to be a warrior and know of that life. As a result, I do not gamble away my family's food or house. I do not make a fool of myself with whiskey and then wake up with a bursting head and heaving stomach. I do not regard the lack of any of these things to be a sacrifice or even a loss.
You are not a man, Junji.
Thou defines a man by his vices, Guipago, not by his spirit.
A man would fight me.
Guipago sailed another card.
Why do you not fight me, Junji?
Thou art not my enemy.
But I am your enemy.
The Kiowa pulled a long, gleaming knife from his belt, turned it, observed it in his hand.
I will kill you with this knife. Tanunki's knife. I am your enemy.
The next day, Guipago pulled up his horse at the top of a jagged escarpment. John walked to his side. A shimmering desert lay before them.
There is no water from here, or even on the other side that a white man can find. That is the no-water country. Today, Junji, the land will test you.
As far as John Ditsworth could see, the emptiness stretched. He saw no color in it or the sky. The unimpeded sun rose over it, crossed it at leisure, and pulled away the color as well as the moisture. The great orb reigned as the cruel prince, the self-consumed monarch of the heavens, tolerating no glory but his own as he strode the land. Beneath John's feet, the earth split and fissured, unable to grasp or hold together under the pressure of the sun's relentless power. He stood looking at the scene until the rope tightened against his neck. At noon, they had not reached the center of the plain. John saw lakes with tree-lined banks and tree-covered islands. They floated before him, then disappeared as their shade and water seemed but a few more steps away. He closed his eyes at last, denying the mirages the chance to tantalize him further. The faces of his wife and children moved against the backs of his eyelids. His tongue swelled, filling the cavity of his mouth. He pressed back against the rope around his neck, letting it draw him on, pulling him, towing him through the waterless sea. Guipago rode under a shade made from his blanket, propped by his bow and quiver. When John fought with thick fingers to loosen and throw off the shirt and jacket, the Indian jerked hard on the rope.
No, Junji.
The strong boots the Quaker wore became leaden weights, anchoring him to the searing ocean bottom. They became wet and clung to his feet until the blisters broke and leather chewed the raw flesh. He walked on until the boots became brittle with salt and fell away in pieces.
How much farther?
We are across. There is water here.
They stopped, and John sank to the ground, seeking shelter from the sun in the shadow of the small canyon that held a spring. 10 yards off, the warrior scraped sand out of a small depression with his hands. He let water from the spring fill the depression before pushing the empty gourd beneath the surface. When it was full, he walked back to the place in the shaded canyon where John lay. The Quaker was little more than a skeleton dressed in scraps of clothing. Guipago wet the rag that now covered his eyes. John twisted away. Guipago held him, then ran the rag over his stubbled face and throat. He replaced it over his eyes. He sat back on his heels. For 3 more days, he watched over John, stripping off his coat, soaking it and the blankets and the scraped pools he made along the way, covering him with the wet, cool cloths until the bursting heat of his body came down.
Do not die, Junji. You must be alive when I kill you, or the vow will be broken.
The vow? I must keep my vow.
I am tired of you. If we were on a raid together, I would leave you. It is customary. I have done it before without a thought. A man expects to be left if he cannot keep up, if he holds the others back and endangers them. Even though you once saved me from death, that is the way of warriors. It is not a good way, but it is the way of warriors. Once some raiders had a man wounded very bad. He was of no use to them. Waiting for him to die would take too much time. So that night, they decided to leave him. They left him at a water hole, near enough so that he could get water if he lived. They left him a little meat, and they piled rocks over him so if he died, he would be buried, and if he lived, the animals would not eat him. They left him very well off. After they left, a wolf came and ate the meat. He was grateful to the man, so he dug away a few stones and lay down beside him. He kept him warm when it became very cold. When other animals came to see if he was dead and could be eaten, the wolf ran them away. He stayed by the man. The man knew he was there. He thought his medicine had sent him the wolf as a protector, so he began to live. He got water. He got some game. The wolf hunted with him. They became brothers. When he came home, the wolf came with him, but he would not stay in the camp. The people did not hurt that wolf ever, because he had saved a Kiowa. But finally, that man moved away to live with the wolf. He lived with him many years, and when he came back, he was a quiet man. I have often thought of that man and that wolf. How could this be? 2 enemies.
Trapped by the sickness of this white man, as he had been trapped by the prison bars, Guipago grew restless. The smooth canyon walls reminded him of his cell. He wanted to breathe. He picked up his rifle and went to look for something to fill his empty belly. Something for John G. to eat. When he opened his eyes, John Ditsworth saw the sliver of moonlit sky between the canyon walls. His head thumped and he was thirsty. He sat up on one elbow and looked about. The fire smoldered, sending threads of gray into the air. Down the canyon, he saw the white markings of Guipago's paint pony. John reached out and took the water gourd.
Guipago? Guipago!
John stood. His legs gave way and he sat back on the sand.
Guipago!
John lay back. He pulled his coat and the blanket to him, but his feet were still cold. He raised himself to pull the short blanket over them. He noticed they were no longer swollen. He ran his hand over the raw redness and knew that they had been oiled and tended.
Guipago.
When the Indian had not returned and the moon had come full over the canyon, John made himself stand. He walked feebly to Guipago's saddle and gear and dropped to his knees. The coffee and sugar, The playing cards, the heavily beaded moccasins, all lay where their owner had left them. This, along with the grazing pony, convinced him that the Indian had not simply abandoned him to die. He looked again at the gear. Only the carbine was missing. Most likely, that meant that Guipago had gone to hunt. If Guipago had gone hunting, he would have gone in daylight. He would not have gone so far that he could not have gotten back before night. Something was wrong with Guipago. He could not get back.
Yes. Yes, he can't get back.
John pulled on Guipago's beaded moccasins. The Indians' women had made them for him, anticipating his return, honoring him, making it special. The Quaker limped and staggered toward the pony.
Take me away, friend horse.
John rode for some time. All in all, he was well pleased to be moving away from his own death.
Wilt thou run again without being sent, John?
But everything was there. Everything for my escape.
Wilt thy faith stand, though sorely tried? In thy vow thou didst put thy trust in God, not in men or circumstances. Thou knowest Guipago is in trouble, or he would have returned. Thou knowest that there is no other help for him but thee. There is no love in what thou dost plan to do, John. Thou art only taking up thine own life again.
By the time he returned to the camp, first light filtered into the canyon. He rode the winding way to the canyon floor, following Guipago's faint footsteps in the red sand. At last he found where Guipago had begun to climb. The teacher dismounted weakly and struggled up the canyon wall. A clear path led off toward the east. He followed until it twisted out of sight and back into the rocks and crevices. John recognized the Kiowa death chant. He followed slowly, tentatively, feeling his way toward it.
Guipago! Guipago, where are you?
Here, John G. The rocks collapsed with me, and I am now in this crevice.
And the Lord will hide thee in a crevice in the rocks.
John ventured to the edge of the path. Below him, Guipago stood looking up from a chamber. Smooth as polished marble, its walls offered nothing to grab hold of and nothing to stand on. It was a perfect prison.
He cannot follow me from there.
John walked hastily back the way he had come. He slid the last 30 feet and fell at the horse's feet. Taking the ropes from Guipago's saddle, John made the return trip as quickly as his weakness would carry him. At the pit, he stopped. He looked, but found no spot to secure the rope.
Canst thou climb, Guipago? I will try to hold thee.
John tied the rope around his waist. He moved back into the rocks, where he could wedge his long body and secure a hold.
Climb, Guipago!
The rope jerked tight on his waist. John pushed harder against the rocks. Guipago caught another hold. The rope jerked again. John slipped, but grabbed and held.
Hurry! Oh, hurry!
Dear God in heaven, I know we can do this together. Amen.
The jerks continued on John's skeletal body. Each time he thought he would come loose, but he held. John was still pushing the rocks when Guipago released the constricted rope and pulled it roughly over his shoulders. The Quaker relaxed and smiled into the Kiowa's face.
This changes nothing.
Guipago tightened the noose around John's neck.
I am still going to kill you, Junji.
At nightfall, they made their last camp.
I do not understand you, Junji. I would have left you.
But thou didst not leave me. Thou nursed me after the desert, cooled me, fed me, dressed my feet with oil.
I must have you alive for tomorrow.
The Quaker sat quietly for a time.
Guipago, I did leave thee.
But you came back.
The Indian poured coffee into a cup and dropped in a handful of sugar. He handed it to John.
What made you come back, Junji?
All my life, I have gone haltingly. If I had left thee, I would never walk sure. I would have left my faith for good.
You kept your vow.
Quipago, dost thou remember the time I came to thy camp with a telegram from Washington that demanded the people turn over the 5 young raiders, or Satanta and Adolte would not be released?
Yes.
When thou heard the message, thou went away to think, and the next morning thou gave me thy answer. Dost thou remember what thou had me write?
I said I wished Washington would let it pass. If those foolish young men have killed any of the people of Texas, they are dead. If some of these young men have been killed, they are dead. Let it all pass. Do not let it make trouble among the living.
Then thou learned that Tanakia had been killed, and thou took the war road. Thou did not let it pass, Quipago.
Tanakia was my son. The wolves had eaten his body. The father cannot look on the scattered bones of his child without remembering his vow to give that child a good life. I failed that vow. I will not fail the one I made to his bones.
John Ditsworth handed the cup back to Quipago.
We drink from the same cup, Quipago. Good night.
The Quaker lay down and closed his eyes. Quipago pulled up his blanket and rolled onto his side. Before he closed his eyes, he thought he saw in the darkness beyond the fire the shining eyes of a wolf. He sat up and chunked a stone at the spot, then lay back. In his dreams that night, Quipago saw the wolf digging up the buried Kiowa and lying down beside him to warm him. He saw the bared teeth as the wolf fought its own kind to protect the Indian.
Why? Why? A wolf and a man are enemies. And yet, that wolf had one spirit with that man.
The two men completed the last few miles and stopped. Quipago turned to John. His eyes never left the Quaker's face. Quickly, with a rough, sure hand, he thrust the knife toward John's throat. The rope fell away. Quipago grabbed the man's arm, jerked it forward, and cut a gash across the palm of his hand. John winced as the blood spurted. Quipago slashed his own hand. He grasped John's, letting their blood flow together. They stood. Each held the other's hand as tightly as he could, forcing his blood, his spirit, into the other. Blood ran down their forearms and dropped onto the sand where Tanakia died, now red with blood again. Quipago released John's hand and walked away. John stood watching. Quipago stopped on a small rise and turned back, looking at John and the bloody place where his son died.
Come, Tungui. Let us go home.
John stood without moving, questioning the Indian with his whole being.
Have I not killed the white man? Your old man is dead. You are my brother, Quipago's brother, Lone Wolf's brother. I give you a new name, Junji. You are now Little Wolf, Tungui. You never left the dying Kiowa, and you made him hope to live again. Come, we are men to make a new road together. I have kept Quipago's vow.